Welcome to Community Connections. I'm Alan Collier, and it's my pleasure to be with you for the next 3 hours. I've got a very interesting man in front of me who I'm going to introduce you to in a minute or two. And then between one and two, we've got Cindy McLeish coming in. We're not talking politics, as you know, but we'll be talking about all the different things that are going on in the community. And then between two and three, we've got one of the hierarchy of the police force coming in, as we do every fortnight, to have a bit of a talk what's going on in the Yarra Valley. But first of all, I've got a gentleman in front of me that it's a job that I didn't know even existed up until a while ago. And we want to find out how he got there and what the job entails. He's now retired, but his name is Jim Pilmer. He's an OAM for all the work he's done around the place. And he's actually a retired police chaplain. And I believe he was the first one to be appointed full-time, and we're going to go through that. But first of all, welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much, Alan. Good to be here.
Great to have you along. Jim, first of all, we want to talk about, because I didn't even realise it, the police did have a chaplain, and I know it's a lot bigger now. But first of all, I believe you have some connection to Hillsville.
Yes, I do. And it's something interesting to talk about, really, in this week so close to Anzac Day. Yep. But my father was a soldier in the Battle of Polygon Wood. Yep. in Belgium, and he was wounded in September in 1917. Very badly wounded. He took six bullets and was shipped back to Australia in a hospital ship, and a long time of recovery. After he came out of hospital, he lived with his brother, my uncle, Charles Pilmer, Uncle Charlie as we knew him, on a mixed farming property up here in Hillsville as part of his recuperation. And so that went on for some time. He actually took a great interest in that eventually and went and did an agricultural course at Dookie College. Yep. But to cut a long story short, wherever Uncle Charlie's farm was, there is now a Pilmer Street here in Hillsville. Yes.
You're not sure where it is?
I went there a long time ago. I couldn't actually take you there.
Yep.
But so the people around Pilmer Street will have a little bit of history of how it got its name. So it was from a Charlie Pilmer who had a farm there.
I don't want to go back too far in your history, but did your father, like if your father was living up here, then he would have been a young man. Did he meet your mother in Hillsville, or was that not?
No, he met my mother in Hawthorne later on. He actually became a postman with a bullet still in his hip, which I could feel as a little boy. I thought it was great to have a dad with a bullet in his hip.
But he didn't.
No, but as I said, at that stage, we don't take this out because it's could damage the sciatic nerve and you'll be in all sorts of strife. So after having great difficulty walking and moving, he actually got a job as a postman at the Kew Post Office, and the walking did him good. Although some mornings, in those days there was two deliveries,
yep.
And when the bullet moved and actually pressed on the nerve, he couldn't walk for a few days, he'd drag me out of bed at 5:30 in the morning. As a little boy, I'd hop on my bike, take the key down to the Kew Post Office, open the post office, wait for the mail van to arrive. The fella would come up in the truck, throw all the bags in on the floor. I'd shut the post office and then go back home. Because he was the postman in charge and he had the key. So it almost sounds like another world, but that's the way it worked.
Jim, did they ever take the bullet out?
No, they never did, no.
True.
No, his other wounds gradually healed with treatment over those months following. But that was on the 26th of September 1917 that he was shot, and that Battle of Polygon Wood is quite a significant battle in the First World War.
Yep. Mm. All right. So now, Jim, we know you've retired as the as a police chaplain, but I want to sort of get ourselves there first of all. Mm-hmm. So as a young boy, obviously you never ever thought you'd be a police chaplain.
No.
And what sort of job did you do? Did you, have you been a minister? And if so, did you have a job? Because some ministers get jobs and then later on commit to the church. How did that happen, Jim?
I was a PM, what was known as a PMG technician, the Postmaster General's Department. So I started that when I was 15 years old.
Yep.
And I guess that was really because Dad said to me, you know, you must get a government job, son. And he'd been through the Depression and the war and all of that stuff. So he actually, they sort of indirectly got me out of school as soon as possible so that I could start to earn money. Not for them, but that was the way fathers thought their sons should act.
When you were in the PMG, what did you do there, Jim?
I was a telephone technician, so I did a five-year apprenticeship and then eventually went into all sorts of interesting work. We had a choice of either being telegraph, which was the old teleprinter thing, telegraph, radio or telephone after our third year. And I chose telephone, and that was largely working in telephone exchanges and installing telephone exchanges or small exchanges in big places like St Vincent's Hospital or the Myers headquarters, all of those things. So it was very interesting work.
One of our presenters is David Oaten, and he was actually one of the technicians that went around to the phone boxes fixing them up.
Yes, right. Yeah. Well, I did that, and then, you know, during all of that process, when I was Rosemary and I were married when we were 21, and went on, but during all of that process, I was always thinking I really want to go into the ministry, and the pull was starting to get stronger.
Is it?
And eventually I went and presented and said, you know, to the Anglican Church, I'm an Anglican priest, said to them, you know, I think I want to train for the ministry. So that was where that all started,
When you say you felt it, how did you feel, Jim? Like, what did you have a passion for people, or what actually was drove you to feel as though you wanted to be an Anglican priest?
Well, a range of things, I think, but because I had I linked in with the local church in Kew, and that was where I met my wife, so that lovely relationship goes way back, but... But it was things like going to Cubs, Scouts, you know, the tennis club, and eventually to Saturday night dances and all those things. The church then was very much a community focus.
It was a social.
It was very social.
Social too,
very
wasn't social. It?
And very, you felt like you were part of a community.
Yep.
So, that eventually, and I was also in the church choir and, you know, etc., which was all very interesting because my parents didn't go to church. That's another part of the interesting thing that was going on in the background. I mean, they didn't object to what I was doing, but they weren't churchgoers themselves. So I finished up, as I say, eventually offering for ordination, and then I needed to start training when I was married and had two daughters, which was all a bit of a challenge. But I suppose to answer your question directly, there was just always that sort of inner voice saying, you know, this is what you want to do. It just became so of great interest to me that I decided to give it a fly.
I've got to take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
Now the winds are blowing and you
Jim, now you and your wife were married. You had a couple of little children. Yep. What sort of age group were they?
Oh, they were sort of at the 10, 12, 13 age group at that stage.
When you joined.
Yeah.
All right. So now, with the church, did you have to move around?
Yes. My first curacy, as we call it, was at All Saints East St Kilda.
Yep.
So I was there for 2 years. Then I was posted out to the first house church, which was an experimental thing for the Anglicans, in North Fitzroy, and that's the first one for the Anglicans, that is, in Australia, I was told.
Yep.
So we spent 7 years there living up on top of the church, so to speak. It looked like a house from the outside.
Yep.
So we lived upstairs, and the little chapel and all the community facilities were downstairs.
Right.
And that was, I went there in 1972.
Yep.
I say 1972, a lot of people think it might have been 1872.
No.
But that was a great experience, because in those days the area was largely Italian and with Greek and Yugoslav people too. So it introduced me, a very small Anglican congregation. I only had about, 20 people when we started. But they were wonderful people who just raised funds and worked like blazes to keep the little congregation going. And I also had St Andrew's Clifton Hill as part of that work at that time.
Right.
So they were areas that introduced me to other faiths, to other cultures, and from there I picked up I started to sort of think about ministering in very different terms to what I would have, I think, if I'd been posted to some other suburbs.
Jim, I've just got to ask you the question, so you've got small children and you're moving around and you've got a wife, and most wives like to move into a house, and I think we've been in ours for 50-something years.
Mm-hmm.
How does your wife and children cope with it? Well, one spot you were 2 years, and then you're somewhere else for 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
How, particularly the children, I mean, and did you ever get sent to the country that far away?
No. All my ministry has been within the Diocese of Melbourne, in the suburbs. My wife and the girls were wonderfully flexible and cooperative, and I like to think that they found it interesting too. some parts of that were very challenging. Mm. But then after the North Fitzroy Clifton Hill appointment, I was posted to Surrey Hills, and I was there for 9 years, at Holy Trinity Surrey Hills. And then after that, I was invited to be the director of the Anglican Marriage Guidance Council, as it was called, which is not just a council, it was actually a counselling agency.
Yep.
And I was there for 9 years. I seemed to do everything in nine. So at the end of all of that, applied, the position of senior police chaplain became available.
I'll just stop you before you go there, because I'll just got to take a quick break, and now this was the next spot I wanted to go to.
This place, but it's too small. I got dreams to chase. My bags are packed and I'm on my way. I'm tearing up that interstate. The only sound in my head, my mama's words when I left. She said, I know you're ready. Off you go. Gone. reminiscing of things that I've been through. Got my windows down, I'm singing out loud. I'm a thinking of you, I know you're proud. I hear your voice and I wanna turn back. Hell no, it's too late for that. Cause I'm already
Jim, I cut you off there because I didn't want to actually just start a conversation and then interrupt it. So you're a minister, you're out in a church, or by there you're in the marriage sector of it. How did you find out about this job that the police wanted a chaplain? And who in the police force decided they needed a chaplain?
well, the first part, how did I find out about it? I was sitting at my desk one day when the phone rang, and our first Anglican woman priest gave me a call, who I didn't know all that well. But Nan rang me up, and I say first priest in the diocese, that is. But she rang me up and said, "Do you know the job of senior police chaplain is going in Victoria Police?" And
was this the first time ever there was a chaplain?
No, there was an organisation called ITIM, the Interchurch Trade and Industry Mission, which provided chaplaincy across the state. But one of the issues for the police in all of that was that you know, the chaplain would go into a town, sort of into Traralgon or Wangaratta or wherever, and they would do the rounds. So they might do a number of different places, including the police station. If you're in a small area in Gippsland, you might do the butter factory and the post office, and then the police station. But it didn't actually quite serve the needs of the police in terms of ongoing chaplaincy and support. So that was Nan ringing up saying, "No, did I know about it? No, I didn't." And she said very kindly, "Well, I think you should look at it." I said, "Well, that's terrific. You know, when do the applications close?" And she said, "On Friday." And she goes, she rings me on Wednesday. So I had no CV and no application forms and no idea what was going on. But I went home and talked to Rosemary about it that night, and we decided to give it a fly.
Yep.
And that's where that all started. Again, to cut a long story short, my application was successful. Yep. I had to be interviewed, of course, by the Chief Commissioner, Neil Comrie, at that stage.
Yep.
And the job description was pretty simple, really, just to provide spiritual support to Victoria Police members, or spiritual support and pastoral care to Victoria Police members and their families. It ran to about two lines, you know.
And this is for the whole of
this
Victoria?
This is for the whole of Victoria, So I believe it runs to many pages now, the job description, as they do in these places. But so... Given that there were many thousands of police, and if you add their families in, you're sort of looking at something like the population of a city the size of Wangaratta. But what they did say was, we would like you to create 32 positions that of voluntary chaplain across the state.
Yep.
And then, you know, to create a network.
So that, can I just ask you this? We'll say something happened at Traralgon or Swan Hill or Hamilton or anywhere like that. You didn't automatically just jump in your car and run up there, did you?
No. Once the network was established, I was able to ring the chaplain in that particular place.
In the first instance, did you have to go to those places?
Yes. It took me about almost 12 months to get those people in place. Yep. So, yes, I was wearing out vehicles at a great rate running around Victoria at that stage, but I managed to get it all into order. And then, although that was 32, that 32 positions was actually nominated by the accountants, not by what the need was. But now it's very gratifying to see that there are, I think, well over 80 voluntary chaplains across Victoria, and there are 3 senior chaplains full time.
Now, Jim, back in your day when you first started it, it would mainly be the Methodist or the Church of Christ or the Anglicans, isn't it? Now, these days, that'd have to be vastly different, wouldn't it? You'd have to cater for a whole lot of religions.
That's true, and that was the thing that actually captured my interest very early in the piece, because I could see that whilst we had a multi-faith community developing at a great rate, and a multicultural community, the police were not receiving really any instruction on how to deal with that multiculturalism. Oh,
and you're talking about now, like the divvy van and these people on the road.
Yeah, well, they're going out to deaths, to injuries, to domestic violence, to all sorts of incidents, and some of those, all of those need sensitivity, but some of them need specific sensitivity around the faith, the religious background of the people involved. If you're going to a Muslim family, Islamic, or you're going to a Jewish family, et cetera, this is an area for sensitivity and tact, and certainly one for training.
Yeah.
So I started to develop a great interest in that, and eventually I was awarded a Churchill Fellowship to study that very topic. So I did 7 weeks overseas looking at multi-faith issues, specifically multi-faith as distinct from multicultural.
Yep.
So multi-faith issues as they relate to operational policing, that was the topic.
Yeah.
It was to bring back something that could start to help police work with the issues of faith in the community. We might, you know, if I said to you how many different faiths are there in our Victorian community, you could probably, like I could, originally come up with 6 or 7.
Yep.
But actually, when you break it down, there are over 120 different faith groups in Victoria. Not some of them are subgroups of other groups, but you know what I'm saying really is that religion and faith becomes a very complex topic, and it can leave the police open to dealing with it inappropriately. Yep. So you know, especially at times of death.
Yep.
So if you go to the death of say an Orthodox Jew, or doesn't have to be Orthodox, just a Jewish person, or Islamic, or Sikh, and Christian, of course, because there are different Christian views to death and to sacraments and to services and to respect and symbolism and all of those things. And then you sort of go, you know, Baha'i and Buddhist, and then you start to think, hey, there's a lot of stuff going on here that we should know about, or police should know about.
Because they're very often at a very, very hard time in a person's life, aren't they?
Yeah, they are indeed. But there are ways to show respect. There are ways to there are ways to treat bodies. I mean, if you're in the homicide squad and you go to a murder of a Jewish person or a Muslim person, you know, there are things to be done there that are of the tradition and of the faith that you don't you don't want to muck up and get wrong, or it backfires on you, and it backfires and hurts the family. So it's all about showing respect for people's different views.
But I guess what you're saying, though, that respect is in various different ways, isn't it? The respect for an Australian, a white Australian person,
yep,
is going to be, the respect is going to have to be different to another faith, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. So we're seeing you know, some issues around that in Victoria at the moment, but that's, yep, that's nothing new. This is, yep, something that is an ongoing thing that needs to be worked at very hard by people on all sides. But I'll hold this up to the microphones so that your listeners can see it. This is a book which was one of the outcomes of all of that. It's called A Practical Reference to Religious and Spiritual Diversity for Operational Police.
Oh, right.
We tried to get a longer title and we couldn't. but if you open that, you can see that there's a little tabs here, so the police can have this book with them.
Yep.
And I'll just read across the top very quickly. So Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, yep, spirituality, Baha'i, Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Maori spirituality and Sikhism. They're all in this book. So if somebody goes to a particular incident, or they know they're going to be, yep, dealing with a particular, that, you know, they might be in an area where we say, well, there are a lot of Buddhists in this area, yep, or we're in a Jewish community, yep, in Caulfield or whatever, yep, they can read this in advance and know about some of the issues that they should be sensitive to.
I've got to take a quick break, Jim, and we'll be back with more.
Running strong from the east to the west, been banging fenders to give you all the best, been setting records in every state. Well, there ain't no car like a big V8. Till the boys from the bush were back in town. Well, the car's in the back and the shutter's down. We're all heading for the Bathurst Hill to see Rocky and the boys serving up a thrill. We've been feeling the heat, you can hear a cuss. We've been kissing fences, been choking on dust. We curse the rain and we curse the sand. We're running hot, fans. To the boys from the bush, we're back in town. The green flag drops and the foot goes down. We're all members of the horsepower set, and the king of the mountain is the guy I gotta get. The ultimate show. To the boys from the bush, we're back in town. Then the car's in the back and the shutter's down. We're all here, we're the Bathurst boys, and you can't hear it, Joe, above the noise. Yeah, to the boys from the bush, we're back in town. Then the big guns roaring, shaking the ground. Checkered flag and you're walking tall. Get the checkered flag and you're walking tall.
Jim, I always feel a little bit sorry for the police because they come out of the academy. Some of them are very young. Some of them, I was talking to one the other day, I think he came out when he was about 50, but a lot of them come out young. They get put on the divvy wagon, which is the first responders, and that's where they start their career or whatever, and they see things that you and I, well, maybe you've seen, that I'd never see in my whole life. Not only do they see it once or twice, they continually see it. Do you find that sometimes that they cope with that while they're in the divvy wagon and maybe 20 or 30 years later something happens and it brings all that trauma back? Or do you find that you have to sort of work with those young people while they're in the divvy wagon? Or the third option is both.
all of the above, really. But I think that one of the things we've learned about post-traumatic stress disorder, the PTSD, is that on the whole, it's cumulative. Obviously, you can go to a particular incident which is horrific, and it has that effect on you and sets you back quite dramatically. But sometimes it is a relatively minor incident that comes at the end of many, many incidents over a career
that
tips you over the edge.
Yep.
And I think in recent years, and the people who work in this area specifically are telling us, you know, that the cumulative aspects of this are really quite common. And it's obviously, if that's the case, well, then some of that can be nipped in the bud further down the track, you know, early in their careers. So it's a case of being aware that around all incidents and being cared for, and the police psychologists and the police welfare section and the police chaplains are all different strands of how the members can be cared for throughout their careers. And part of the problem is, I say problem, but part of our challenge is to create awareness amongst the workforce that we are all available to look after them. And it is okay to say, I'm not travelling very well, which is a hard thing for anyone to do because they don't want to be identified as not coping.
And particularly guys, because they used to be told years ago, man up.
Yeah, they used to.
While we're talking about this cumulative effect, I know that you were involved with the tragedy when those four police officers lost their lives on the Monash Freeway. Did that trigger any major incidents within the police, the people themselves? And do you believe that down the track that it could cause some troubles?
It was traumatic in a major way. Yes, it was on the Eastern Freeway.
Eastern, that's right, sorry.
interesting thing about that is that it was the fifth anniversary of that crash yesterday.
Was it?
Yes, and it's hard to believe that, in one sense, it's hard to believe that those 5 years have gone quickly, and in another sense, for all of those involved, it's been a long, long time of grief and pain. But, so we had a little service at Berrindarra early yesterday morning just to lay a wreath and remember them. And on the night that happened, I was one of a number of chaplains that were called in to do the various death notifications, as we call them, but we had to go and tell the parents of the next of kin of all of those members what had happened, and I went to the Prestony family that night, and all of those things, that experience stays with us all forever. You know,
I was just going to say, Jim, like on a personal note, like it must be terrible driving there, and you know that when you knock on that door, their life's never, ever going to be the same.
Yeah.
How personally do you cope with it too?
I try to apply my faith to it, but actually what you're really doing at that time is operating on your emotions, and you know, you haven't got slick answers to give anybody, but all you can really do is be there. And that's come to be, I think, recognised by all of our chaplains, that the being there, just not necessarily giving smart answers, but just being with people and trying to comfort them. And and then, you know, obviously for... there were four funerals to be arranged for all of those that died. And so we then move into that sort of mode, I suppose, that we've got to be involved in preparing the services and liaising with the police and others and with their families. So it's quite a complex thing.
And after that, Jim, does the chaplain stay involved with the family for a number of years?
Yes, yes, the Prestonys were with us yesterday morning at Berendera.
So you've kept in contact with them personally?
Yes, and all the chaplains do that. That personal contact's important, and obviously, as in all cases when we're grieving, you know, it changes over time.
Yep.
People have different needs, an enormous amount of support from the police force as a whole, from the members and the colleagues. Yep. You know, it's one of the amazing things that it operates like a family.
Well, I was just going to say that. Yep. I've interviewed a number of police, and we've got between two and three today, another one coming. They talk about the family of police, don't they? They don't talk about a job. They talk about the family of police.
The support is quite amazing. But it's that was a very sad incident, and as I say, five years ago, yesterday.
Jim, just quickly, not just quickly, because I've got to take another break in a minute. I'll come back to that. No, I'll come to that. I'll take this quick break. We'll be back.
Let me tell you of an interview with an old man he knew. He's got a beak and feathers and things, but the poor old fella ain't got no wings. Aren't you jealous of the wedge-tailed eagle? And battle it, da-da-da. Well, the eagle's flying round and round to keep it 2 feet firmly on the ground. Now, I can't fly, but I'm telling you, I can run the pants of a kangaroo. But I do. For the 50 cents, da-da-da-da. The designer should have had more sense. Da-da-da-da. If you take a look, it'll prove to you I ran the pants of that kangaroo. But take a look, it'll prove to you you ran the pants of a kangaroo. The loon like a cockatoo, da-da-da-da. Swoop and toss like an albatross, da-da-da-da. You silly galah, I'm better by far than a white cockatoo or a budgerigar. They squeak and squawk and try to talk. Why, me and them's like cheese and chalk. But you can't fly, but I'm telling you, we can run the pants of a kangaroo. Last time I saw old man, he knew him, da-da-da-da. He was chasing a female, he knew him, da-da-da-da. As he shot past, I heard him say, she can't fly, but I'm telling you, she could run the pants of a kangaroo. But I do. She can't fly, but I'm telling you, she could run the pants of a kangaroo. There is a moral to this ditty, da-da-da-da. Thrush can sing, but he ain't pretty, da-da-da-da. Duck can swim, but he can't sing, nor can the eagle on the wing. Emu can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can run the pants of a kangaroo. Well, the kookaburra laughed, and he said it's true, da-da-da-da-da.
Jim, you've also done some other work with the major collision people too, because they must see some terrible scenes.
They do indeed. When I retired from full-time work as a senior chaplain, I was off for about 3 months thinking I'd retired, when I got a call asking me to come back and do a little bit of part-time work for a few months with the homicide squad. They had some special needs at that time. Yep. And Chief Commissioner asked me if I'd come back. Well, to cut a long story short, I stayed for 8 years.
Did you?
Yes, but only doing one day a week homicide, and then was asked to do major collision as well. So I finished up doing 2 days a week for 8 years. That wasn't voluntary. I was being paid for the 2 days. but part of that was because the nature of the work intrigued me, fulfilled me, if I can use that word, for things that are pretty awful in people's lives. But there was a particular role for ministry and pastoral care.
For the members again?
For the members. I tried to also extend it to the families of the victims, and just saying to chaplains in general, you know, you do have a role with the people around this.
I was going to ask that. Yeah. Did say there was a murder, we'll say. So you still got a bit involved with the families as well, did you?
Yes. It's a bit of terminology, but I tried to push it a bit, and especially with some of the parliamentary hearings in Victoria about how we work with victims in Victoria, the term secondary victims, because when you have an incident, a murder, there are often people around that, apart from the families and the related people, but there are often a lot of other people around murders or car fatalities that are nothing to do with the families, but they see it and they hear it, or you know, to be frank, often they smell it, and that stays with them for life. So it's no good just sort of giving them the flick and saying, well, you go home and forget all about that, because they don't. So I'm still trying to push that attitude at government level, to say, you know, we do need to look after the people around the scene, because many of them need, sometimes weeks or even months later, say, I don't think I'm travelling so well. That was a particular case after the Bourke Street incident where Gargasoulis ran through, and there were hundreds of people sought counselling after that. Hundreds.
Was it?
I think there were well over 1,000 people who formally sought support.
So did you have to supply that support?
No.
Or you organised the support?
I wasn't in a position to organise that, but I was just trying to say, you know, we need to be doing more after certain scenes. So major collision was one area that I worked with, supporting the troops there, and then the homicide squad, I used to go in a day a week and be chaplain to them too, but that was an interesting sort of extension of my ministry.
Jim, pardon me, when you first started, you're the only full-time chaplain?
Yeah.
So were you available? Like, how did they chase you? Could they chase you 24 hours a day?
They could, and they did.
Did they?
Oh, yes. It was pretty demanding, I have to say. But, you know, we got through that. I look back on all of that sometimes and wonder how. But, again, that was, I have to say, with the support of family and their wonderful support and flexibility around that. Yep. I mean, I have to say, as part of that, there were a lot of happy things that helped to keep me sane too. Like, I married quite a few police couples. And I baptised quite a number of their kids, and you know, all of that sort of side of it was therapeutic for me.
Just quickly, Jim, I know that you've got something to do with the St John's or something.
St John,
we're fast running out of time.
Right. I'm what they call state chaplain to St John Ambulance. That's not Ambulance Victoria, it's quite separate, and a lot of people often confuse the two. But St John Ambulance is a wonderful organisation that provides first aid at all sorts of in all sorts of areas. If you're at the tennis at the Australian Open, or you know, at the Melbourne Cup, and you have a heart attack or whatever, they're the people who come to you. But they also have a coroner's section where now are the ones who look after deceased people, the transporting of deceased people.
I was just going to say to you, I thought they wouldn't see half the problems that the police do.
No, there's a wonderful crew of 35 people who work, about 35, who work 24/7 to do that work.
Jim, I've got to go. The news is knocking on the door. I really appreciate you coming in. It's a job that I didn't even know existed until a while ago. So thank you for all you've done for the families and Victoria.
My pleasure. Thanks. You.